Hello, my name is Colin Daniels. I'm the Working Age and Young People Service Manager for the Macular Society. Now, as you might know, the Macular Society hosts two live webinars each month focusing on all aspects of living with macular disease. We speak to leading experts, clinicians, and researchers about the latest in macular disease. The first of the webinars focuses very much on age-related macular degeneration, and the second on areas for people of a working age and a bit younger. Now, we understand that not everyone has the opportunity to watch our webinars, so we have decided to turn some of the content into podcasts. The podcasts will be available on all good podcast platforms. So here we go. So my name is Colin Daniels, and I'm the Working Age and Young People Service Manager for the Macular Society. This is part of our virtual clinics service, which we started as a way of keeping patients up to date in research, and treatment for various conditions around macular disease. So today, we've been kindly joined by Professor Andrew Lotary, who's going to talk about Stargardt disease, which is fabulous because it's a condition I have myself. Personally, I've had it since I was eight, so I started young, and just for the, I only look 28, but I'm cruising on 50, so I've had it quite a while, so it'll be quite interesting to hear what Andrew's got to say about that, so thank you, Andrew. And also today, as always, we've got my esteemed colleague, Jerry Hode, who's our research manager, who will hopefully tell us a little bit about some researchy bits at the end, and she's also going to help with the chat. And I know for a fact that quite a lot of people with Stargardt disease know quite a lot about the condition, and you can ask some really good questions, so I'm aware of that. So, Jerry, do you just want to say quickly say hi?
Good evening, everybody. Yeah, as Colin said, I've run the research programme at the Macular Society, and we fund projects that are looking for a cure for Stargardt's, and we support people with Stargardt's.
Fabulous. Well, in that case, without further ado, we'll get back to you a little bit more about that a little bit later on. So, Andrew, thank you ever so much. You saved my little soul. You rescued me at quite short notice. So thank you very much.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Colin. Thank you. And thank you to everybody for joining tonight. And I'm doing something that makes me feel a little bit naked, if you like, in that I'm talking without. And I once heard that the definition of an expert with someone who comes from somewhere else and carries slides. But I thought, you know, particularly for a visually impaired audience, it would be nice not to use slides. So Colin mentioned that he has Stargardt's disease, and actually it is quite a common cause of visual loss. It's a commonest juvenile form of macular degeneration. And it's estimated that there's about 1 in 10,000 people have this condition. And Colin mentioned that he was affected, I think, from age 8, and it can affect people in childhood or late childhood. But interestingly, there's a spectrum. We're now, in recent years, appreciating that some people are affected with Stargardt's much later in life, and over the age of 40 or even in their 50s when they're first diagnosed. So it can be quite a spectrum of how much it affects people. I saw a lady in my clinic who was presenting in her 50s or early 60s this week, and her brother was affected in his early 20s. So even within a single family, there can be a spectrum of when it affects people in terms of their eyesight. And it's interesting to speculate why that might be. But as I say, it's the commonest juvenile form of macular degeneration, the macula being the central part of the retina, the tissue that senses light at the back of the eye. And another condition is called age-related macular degeneration, which also affects this part of the eye and affects central vision, but that typically affects people over the age of 50 and more commonly in their 70s or 80s. So Dr. Stargardt described this condition in 1909. Similar condition called fundus flavi maculatus was described, I think, in the 1930s. And as many people here on the call who are affected will know, it affects usually central vision getting blurred, or maybe in some people, their optician will have noticed changes at the back of their eye and referred them in for evaluation of a hospital. And during my career, it's interesting, the way the condition is diagnosed has changed a little bit. We used to do fluorescein angiograms where we inject the dye into the back of people's arms, and that goes up to the back of the eye. We take photographs as that dye fluoresces and it goes through the blood vessels at the back of the eye. And there's a very particular appearance in fluorescein angiography called a dark choroid, where the photographs of the back of the eye look darker than normal. And we used to do that to diagnose Stargardt's disease. And I'll explain why that, we now understand why the choroid looked dark on fluorescein angiography. But in recent years, we have more less invasive tests. So we can take photographs of the eye and look at the structure of the retina with a test called an OCT scan. And so in Stargardt's patients, you would see perhaps thinning of the retina in the center, and you might see little extra deposits at the back of the eye underneath the tissue that senses light, the retina, lying between the retina and the cells underneath that, called the retinal pigment epithelium. And we have another non-invasive test to measure the fluorescence light coming from the eye, and that's called autofluorescence imaging. And that, without injecting any dye, can show a specific pattern of fluorescent light in patients with Stargardt's disease. So these non-invasive tests are have kind of replaced fluorescein angiography now as one of the key tests. Another test people might have is an electroretinogram, where we measure the electrical response of light from the back of the eye. But again, that's done less frequently. And really, one of the most definitive tests we can do now is genetic testing. Stargardt's disease is normally what's called a recessive disease, and that means that both parents of an affected person are carriers of a faulty gene. And if they have two copies of each, essentially each gene in your body, and so you give one of those copies to a child and the other, another copy comes from the other parent. And if you get a faulty copy from mum and dad, then you develop Stargardt's disease. And by tracing faulty genes through families and mapping the disease onto using genetic markers, eventually in 1997, both the location and the gene that causes Stargardt's disease was identified. And that gene's called ABCA4. ABCA4 is a really interesting gene. It's a very big gene. Genes are split up into what are called exons, which are the bits of the DNA code that are come together to make a protein. And they're separated by intervening sections of DNA called introns, which are spliced out. So the exons come together, and then that code turned into a protein, which is actually what has the function in the cells at the back of the eye. So some genes are just single exon genes, some are three exon genes. The ABCA4 gene is 50 exons long, which makes it a very large piece of DNA. And that is relevant to treatments, as we'll come on to. But by finding the gene, we could then understand what's the mechanism that leads to cell death in the back of the eye that we see as Stargardt's disease. So the ABCA4 gene is a gene that metabolizes vitamin A. And vitamin A is used as part of what's called the phototransduction cascade. The phototransduction cascade is a chemical reaction that happens every time a photon of light strikes a photoreceptor. It creates a chemical reaction that eventually generates an electrical current that carries a visual signal back to the brain. And vitamin A is important in that chemical reaction, of which goes in a circle and uses different chemicals to generate that electrical reaction. When vitamin A goes through that chemical reaction, it is broken down into waste products, and particularly a waste product called A2E. And what the ABCA4 gene is, essentially, it's the garbage disposal. It gets rid of that waste product from particularly the rod cells, which are the rod photoreceptors, which we use to sense light in dim light. And if this gene is not working correctly, that pumping mechanism of pumping out the garbage from the cells that sense light doesn't work efficiently. And so the waste product, A2E, builds up in the rod photoreceptors and has a very detergent effect. And so it causes the rod cells to degenerate. Now, normally the rod cells, the outer segments of the rod cells are, every night, the outer segments are metabolized or are eaten away by the cells underneath the retinal pigment epithelium. And that's normal. And then that allows the regeneration of this outer segment of the rod cell, which is necessary for for us to see light. But this unhealthy material that's stuck in the rods is then digested by the cells underneath the retinal pigment epithelium. And the retinal pigment epithelium can't digest it either. And so it builds up on the lining of cells underneath the retina. And that has a couple of effects. Firstly, it blocks the fluorescent signal when we do a fluorescein angiogram. And that's why on the fluorescein angiogram, we get this dark appearance on the fluorescein angiogram because of the buildup of this material in the cells at the back of the eye. And secondly, these cells underneath the photoreceptors, they are also affected and they over time can be damaged and wear away and atrophy. So you lose both the photoreceptors that sense light and their supporting cells underneath the retinal pigment epithelium. And you also get clumps of material, which is the little bright spots that are very typical when we look into the back of someone's eyes with Stargardt's disease, and which may alert an optician, say, that there's a problem in the early stages. And the other thing is the appearance of the retina changes colour. And so the classic description of Stargardt's retina is it's a vermilion colour, sort of a dark red. And again, we now realise that's the build-up material of vitamin A byproducts, A2E, that is not being properly metabolised. So, as I say, the ABCA4 gene is a very large gene and it makes a very large protein. And you can have different faults in this gene, different genetic mutations. So you can have a fault that disrupts almost all of the function of this gene. And that there's different types of genetic mutations. There's some that stop the entire transcription of the gene into a protein. And if you have one of these more deleterious effects, you get more loss of function of the gene. And interestingly, that sort of mutation gives an appearance at the back of the eye of another condition called retinitis pigmentosa. So that's a more widespread damage to the back of the eye, more peripheral changes in the retina, and probably more severe vision loss. If you have a milder change in the gene, which still makes the protein, but it's less efficient, it doesn't fold as well as it should, for example, then you're likely to get Stargardt's disease. And that's most of the mutations are what are called missense mutations and lead to Stargardt's disease. And then another set of mutations can affect the cone cells more than the rod cells. And then you get what's described as a cone rod degeneration. So apart from understanding the mechanism of why Stargardt's disease leads to damage, which leads to visual loss, we now understand that different mutations in this one gene can give three very different clinical appearances of cell death at the back of the eye: retinitis pigmentosa, Stargardt's disease, and cone rod dystrophy. Because we know the gene, it's now possible to do genetic testing. It's not available in every hospital in the UK, but it's meant to be becoming available in every hospital. It's meant to be the financial barriers that stopped genetic testing happening are meant to have been resolved. So it should be possible to get genetic testing to molecularly confirm a diagnosis of Stargardt's disease. Because it's such a large gene, as I mentioned, there are literally thousands of different mutations, different changes in the code of this gene. And indeed, even in people with no signs of an eye disease, you will find changes in this gene. So my ABCA4 gene is probably different to Geraldine's ABCA4 gene. And part of the challenge of interpreting the genetic results is because there are so many changes in this gene, some will cause disease and some won't. And so we sometimes you get a genetic test result back and the laboratory is not sure if the changes they find in the gene will cause disease or not. But other times you get a result back and it has been seen in many other patients with Stargardt's disease in the lab, it's very certain that these changes cause the disease. And so genetic screening, I think, can be helpful for several reasons. One, to absolutely confirm the clinical diagnosis. And there are some other diseases, particularly in children and young children, that have a similar appearance to Stargardt's disease. One particularly nasty neurological disease called Batten's disease can look quite like Stargardt's disease. And it's a life-threatening disease, Batten's disease. So it's very nice if you can exclude that disease with genetic testing. So it's helpful to make an absolute certain diagnosis. Also, for potential future treatments, it would be helpful to know, confirm the genetic, have a genetic diagnosis. So patients with Stargardt's disease often ask me what the risk is of their children. And because it's a recessive disease, you need a person with Stargardt's disease who has two faulty copies of the ABCA4 gene. They can only give one of those copies to their child, and the other copy of the gene comes from their partner. So providing their partner is not also a carrier of a faulty Stargardt's gene, the child will not be affected. So because of the frequency of the gene in the population, in general, the risk of an affected child of a person who has Stargardt's disease is probably less than 1%. It's a low risk that a child will be affected. That risk goes up in some populations where there's, you know, consanguineous marriages, where, you know, people might have married a second cousin, and then there's an increased risk that both parents will be carrying a faulty gene. But in general, the risk of an affected child is low. So when this gene was discovered, say in 1997, one thing that scientists were able to do was to remove this gene in mice and create a mouse model of Stargardt's disease. And that produced some interesting results. So the mouse retina had similar appearance to what we see in humans. It had deposits at the back of the eye that look very similar to a human. And one interesting thing you can do to a mouse that you can't do to a human is you can raise it in dark, you can keep it in dark conditions and avoid light. And what was interesting in the mouse model, if the mouse was not exposed to light, it didn't develop the retinal changes. And this suggests that if you reduce light exposure in patients with Stargardt's disease, it would slow their condition down, it would slow progression. And from what we know of the mechanism of how this gene is important for processing chemicals that are part of the reaction to light in the eye, and what we've seen in the mouse model, it seems sensible advice to advise patients to try to avoid bright light. And obviously you can't live in gloom, but I do think it's sensible to avoid, you know, bright sunny conditions, to have sunglasses, a hat, wraparound sunglasses. Maybe if you wear glasses, glasses that react to light and darken in bright conditions, to avoid excessive light exposure. And anecdotally, I've had one or two patients who have gone off to sunny, very sunny holidays abroad, and their vision's noticeably worsened when they come back. As I say, the fundamental problem is not being able to metabolize vitamin A as well as you should. And so another thing patients should avoid is taking vitamin A supplements or something called beta-carotene, which is a pro form of vitamin A that is metabolized vitamin A. And unfortunately, I've seen some patients thinking it would help their eyes take extra vitamin A supplement. And unfortunately, that's made their eyesight worse. I have two sisters, one of whom took vitamin A, one didn't, and the sister who took vitamin A with the disease, unfortunately, her eyesight was much worse, and her sister was also affected who didn't. So you need vitamin A to stay alive. I'm not saying avoid vitamin A, I'm just saying avoid the vitamin A supplements. I'm often asked what foods vitamin A are in. The highest concentration is in the liver, but you know, most patients don't eat liver. So, but just don't take vitamin A supplements. The appearance in the retina, the thinning around the center of the back of the eye, the macula, looks quite similar to the appearance you get if you have to take a drug called Plaquenil, or hydroxychloroquine, which is a drug sometimes given to prevent malaria. And it's given to patients with rheumatoid arthritis and SLE. And it seems that patients with Stargardt's disease, with some evidence, it can make their Stargardt's disease worse. So the one drug you should definitely try to avoid taking if you have Stargardt's disease is hydroxychloroquine, also called Plaquenil. Sometimes I'm referred patients to try to decide whether they've got hydroxychloroquine damage to their eyes or Stargardt's disease. I should also say just about the visual outcome of patients with Stargardt's disease. It is very variable, and there are some patients who are quite mildly affected, but once vision starts to deteriorate, there are some papers that suggest that within 5 years of vision dropping a couple of lines, the average visual acuity is been able to read just the top line on a visual acuity chart. And patients are aware of their vision dropping and they're worried they're going to go completely blind. But often when you get to that level of just reading the top line of the vision chart, it can sort of stabilize at that level and not progress much more than that. So the median visual acuity, the average visual acuity, is around what's called 660, which means just reading the top line on the chart. But obviously there's some variation. Some people read better than that, some people read worse. So at the moment, our treatments are avoiding excessive light, avoiding extra vitamin A, avoiding hydroxychloroquine. In most people, it just affects the center of the back of the eye. So the peripheral retina is more healthy. Some people can be helped with low vision aids, with magnification, using devices like iPads to enlarge text. Colin, I'm sure, could explain, would much be better than me, could advise what visual aids he finds helpful. And that is sort of what we can do now. But we'd obviously like to do more. And so there's understanding the mechanism, how there's this buildup of unhealthy material from vitamin A breakdown. There are several clinical trials underway trying to come up with treatment. So a trial that I'm involved in, using a drug called Sorafenib, and this drug was initially developed as a peptic ulcer treatment. And as part of its development, it was discovered, as part of it looking for how it affected different tissues of the body, it was discovered it could remove this unhealthy fluorescent material from the back of the eye. So it was a totally random, serendipitous discovery, and that it had this property of removing waste products from the back of the eye. And so it was tested in mice. Again, we were genetically engineered to have a faulty ABCA4 gene, and it promoted cell survival in the retina, made their eyes were healthier, responded better to light than if they weren't given the drug. And so that drug's now in early clinical trials. And the results of the clinical trials will probably be available in another year or so. They're still ongoing, but I'm hopeful that in a year or 18 months, we'll see what effect the drug has. The outcome measure for this study is reduction in the autofluorescent material that builds up in Stargardt's disease. Interestingly, visual acuity is not a good outcome measure in Stargardt's disease. If you follow patients with Stargardt's disease, somewhat surprisingly, even if you don't do any treatment, the visual acuity improves in the vision chart. And that somewhat surprised me, but I think it's because people start to use their eccentric vision more, but that's been shown in natural history studies. So we need to come up with other measures to see whether a treatment's effective in Stargardt's disease. Another innovative way to perhaps treat this disease, you can make the vitamin A molecule has hydrogen bonds in it, and you can make an isotope of hydrogen called deuterium. And this chemically modified form of vitamin A doesn't break down as much as normal vitamin A. And again, in the mouse model has been very helpful. If you feed mice the altered form of vitamin A that has deuterium hydrogen molecules, you get less buildup of waste material in their eyes. And again, this modified vitamin A is now being tested in clinical trials. Other things that are being looked at, actually earlier this evening, I went to clinicaltrials.gov, which is a website run by the US government that lists all of the ongoing studies for any disease. So it's a good place to go and see what the latest studies are. So I looked for Stargardt's disease. I thought I would see something about gene therapy, but there's nothing as yet listed as an active clinical trial of gene therapy for Stargardt's disease. That has certainly been planned. And the idea would be to replace the faulty gene with a normal copy of the gene to restore the function in the back of the eye. As I mentioned earlier, this is a very large gene, and that causes problems because the gene is actually too, normally the way you do gene therapy is put a gene into a virus and then inject that virus into the eye. And then the virus puts the gene you want in the eye into the cells at the back of the eye. Unfortunately, the ABCA4 gene is too big to fit into the normal viruses that are used for this. So different strategies are being created, such as splitting the gene in half and putting half of it in one viral particle and half in another, and then getting the gene to reconnect into one single gene inside the cell. So there's approaches are being made to try to make this effective, but it hasn't got the clinical trials yet. You also get inflammation in the back of the eyes with the generation of this disease and the buildup or the activation of a protein called complement. So people are also, there's also clinical trials looking at inhibiting the complement damage seen in the back of the eyes with Stargardt's disease. A drug, a very common drug that is used to treat diabetes called metformin, is also being looked at as a possible treatment. It has what's called neuroprotective effects, and it's been assessed in a clinical trial as well in the States. I'm often asked about stem cell therapy, and what's possible at the moment is to inject cells that sit underneath the retina, that either as individual cells, the cells that make up the retinal pigment epithelium, or to inject them as a sheet. So they have been injected as individual cells in patients with Stargardt's disease, and they survived in the few patients that have been tested, but there was no increase in function. And there's perhaps long-term stem cell therapies would be helpful if we had the understanding to totally regenerate the retina, but we don't have that understanding yet. So I'm afraid it's perhaps been overhyped at the moment how soon a stem cell therapy would be available. But there are, as I mentioned, there are several studies in clinical trials, vitamin A altered study, the Turing vitamin A, the complement inhibition, and the Sorafenib study that I'm involved in. And I hope that gene therapy studies will be available soon. These trials are probably most likely to stop further deterioration rather than improving vision. So again, I don't want to raise people's hopes too high at this stage, and it takes a long time for each step along the way. But you know, if they're shown to be safe and effective in the most severely affected patients, then I'm sure that they would then be used in patients at earlier stages of disease before they have significant sight loss. A good way to find out about what research is going on, of course, is to be part of the Macula Society and get their updates, because they're very good at informing patients about the latest research. You can also go to that clinicaltrials.gov website. So I think that's really all I wanted to say.
Brilliant. Thank you, Andrew. That's been really interesting. Loads of information there. I know we've had a lot of questions in the chat, some of which you answered along the way. We've had a few come in now. And now, because I'm beneath that 660 level, I can't see the chat at all. So I'm going to hand over to Jerry to ask those questions. So, Jerry, do you want to just sort of go through the chat and ask some questions to Andrew?
There's a couple of ones in relation to sunlight. So somebody is asking, does the same guidance around sunglasses and avoiding sunlight apply to people with retinitis pigmentosa? And does artificial light have a negative impact, I presume, in the same way as sunlight does?
So regarding the retinitis pigmentosa, is maybe over 80 different forms of it. And there are some forms of retinitis pigmentosa that seems to have an effect on, I would say, particularly people who have got a rhodopsin mutation, which is an autosomal dominant form of retinitis pigmentosa. Patients who have what's called sectorial retinitis pigmentosa, where it just affects the lower half of the retina and they get a visual field effect up above. We know more light hits the lower half of the eye, and so it seems there's excess damage that happens in these patients because they're getting more light in the lower part of their eye. And there's an animal model, rhodopsin RP, a dog model this time, and if the dogs get bright light, they get an injury almost immediately in their retina. There has been some brave patients with retinitis pigmentosa who've put a patch over their eye for over a year and had one eye patched and one not, and when they took the patch off at the end of that year, there was no difference in their retinitis pigmentosa between their eyes. So retinitis pigmentosa is a lot of different conditions. So I think because we don't know exactly which forms of retinitis pigmentosa, It helps. I think it will help some, but not all, but it's sensible advice just to try to avoid really bright sunlight. Artificial light doesn't have the same really high energy that sunlight does. I don't think it will have the same negative impact.
Somebody sounds like they know a lot about the soroprazole trial. I think it's ending in 5 days. Why isn't the data available sooner than you suggested?
Yeah, so there's been an extension to the trial, so it's still ongoing. So the study was originally funded by the European Union, and that funding, it's correct, it's ending, but the patients who were funded by the European Union have gone on to an extension study so that there's a longer follow-up of the patients. There were some missed visits, understandably, because of COVID, and therefore to get more information, it's been extended. Recruitment was slower than was hoped for, so it is actually ongoing for, as I say, for about another year.
So I imagine you're following the patients after you finish the treatment for some period of time. So.
Yes, and some patients are still on treatment.
Okay.
And so it's done. The regulations differ from country to country to country, and some countries were slower to get started than others. So it's kind of finished in the UK, but it's ongoing in Italy at the moment, and it's all patients in the same study.
The end of a trial is just the start of it. It's a phase 3 trial, a pivotal trial. Could you explain a bit about what happens after, if there's been favourable results, the process of licensing and so forth, particularly in the UK?
So typically drugs go through 3 phases of testing. Phase 1 studies assessing safety. And because this drug I was involved in, Serapazan, had already been tested for peptic ulcer treatments, that safety was already known. Phase 2 study, it's what we're doing at the moment, is to see if there's any sign that it works, that it's effective. And that then, if that does show an effect, then to have a drug approved, you have to then have a larger study called the phase 3 study in a larger group of patients to confirm that it is effective. And indeed, sometimes you need to have 2 phase 3 studies, 2 different populations. And if after you've done all that, you find an effect, then the data from the studies is reviewed by regulators in different countries, in America, in Europe, in the UK, and the regulators will decide whether that drug can have a license or not. If they're happy, it's safe and effective. So they very extensively look at the data, and often this can be a 400 or 500 pages of documents to look through. And then if they say, yes, it's okay to have a drug license and be used, then the National Health Service would look at it and say whether it should be funded or not, the National Health Service. And that's the National Institute of Clinical Excellence would assess that. And they would review all the evidence and decide not just is it effective, but is it economically effective? Does the quality of life improve enough to justify the expense of the drug? And they would review the data. And that can take a year for their assessments, and it can take a year for the regulator to assess things. And it can take 3 or 4 years for the phase 3 studies. So it's a very long process. I would say starting at phase 1, you're lucky if you get to a treatment within 10 years. But it is important to make sure drugs are safe and effective. So that's the sort of time frame. I think back to gene therapy for Leber's congenital amaurosis, which is a rare early onset form of retinitis pigmentosa, and it was first found to be effective in a dog model 20 years ago, and it took 20 years for it to become licensed on the NHS, and so it is a going from showing an effect in an animal model to getting regular approval to do a clinical trial to getting approval on the NHS and other countries, it took essentially 20 years. So somewhere between 10 and 20 years is the sort of time frame, unfortunately, at the moment it takes.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing what they achieved with the COVID vaccines. If anything that was learned from that can speed the process up, it would be great. I keep saying Like people keep saying to me, they can do it for COVID, can't they do it for, can't they speed things up a bit?
Yeah.
There's obviously this, you may know this person, she's just completed completed 2 years on your trial. Interested in knowing how many people took part in that trial altogether across the EU, and when she might find, they might find out if they received the placebo or the active drug.
Yeah, so thanks. I think there was 9 patients in Southampton on the study in total, and I'm not 100% sure, certain. I think it's somewhere between 60 and 100 patients overall in the study. And the data is locked, unfortunately, until the study is completed. So I'm afraid, yes, we'll have to wait to the end of for another year. And I don't know what drug people were on. I was not allowed, you know, to make the results more reliable, I'm not allowed to know what drugs people actually got. So yeah, sorry, but we will tell you as soon as we're allowed to.
Sure, thank you. So somebody's asked about inflammation. You mentioned inflammation in the retina. So is it typical with Stargardt's, and what symptoms would cause it?
It's not obvious clinically, but if you look at, you know, for example, postmortem retinas of patients with Stargardt's disease, at the microscopic level, there's complement defense system, you see increased complement activity. And you see that in lots of diseases in the back of the eye. You see it in macular degeneration, you see it in glaucoma. So it's not the prime, it's sort of a secondary effect of having the disease. And so there are different complement inhibitors being tested for a variety of diseases in the retina, particularly age-related macular degeneration. And there are some similarities between how Stargardt's disease looks and age-related macular degeneration looks, that has meant that some researchers have thought it might be worth seeing if that would be helpful or not. And some of the drugs that are being developed for age-related macular degeneration are now being tested for Stargardt's disease. I think it's very early days, how effective. We just don't know yet how effective that would be.
Are you thinking of Zemira?
Yeah.
There's the drug that's in trials for AMD and Stargardt's. Okay. Okay, one about inheritance. And can siblings of Stargardt patients now have their genes tested? My sister was told her eyes were clear 20 years ago and that she was probably a carrier but wouldn't have had her genes tested. So can siblings be tested?
Probably, yes. And I mean, I think normally what you would do is test the person affected and see if you can find the changes in the gene, and if they were confirmed, then you know what changes to look for in the siblings, and it's relatively straightforward. So the way this would normally be done would be by talking to being referred to a clinical genetics department, and they could arrange testing. Some ophthalmologists would feel confident to do that, but not all of them. But it should be possible to ask your ophthalmologist to be, you know, how you get tested and how to, and then, you know, the family would, anybody's interested in the family could go talk to a clinical geneticist about the pros and cons of being tested. Yeah, so yes, it should be possible now. Testing has become a lot easier than it used to be.
Thank you. People were, a couple of questions about the cost, I think probably relating to the, when you mentioned about NICE considering the cost effectiveness of the drug, and if the soroprazole is already a drug for peptic ulcers, it's probably not an very expensive drug, is that right?
So it wasn't developed as a peptic ulcer drug, that was its initial idea. So it was bought for a company who's now developing it for Stargardt's disease. So I have no idea what cost it's likely to be. It would have to reflect all the costs doing the clinical trials, it could be that cost. So I don't know. I mean, I think you would think it would be much cheaper than, for example, a gene therapy. It'd be much easier to administer, so it should be cheaper. But that's a commercial decision. I don't know. It's not. Yes. It's not a drug that can be repurposed. It's not a drug that you can go and. That's available for any other indication at the moment, which would make it easier.
Okay, well, it's worth mentioning that NICE often negotiate with the company to get an NHS discount. And that's a commercially confidential. So there's the list price, and then they may often negotiate a discount for the NHS, and then that price is commercially confidential. We don't know
a very hard bargain with companies, and we do get treatments considerably cheaper, often, you know, maybe 50% cheaper than they would be in the United States, for example. So they're, because of the large number of patients in the NHS, they can usually drive a hard bargain. Often it's confidential what the price is.
And it's very much about assessing the quality of life for people with Stargardt's, and it must be a long-term disease that affects a great deal of people's lives, and therefore the quality of life balance is very important.
The quality of life over many years, how much that can be improved by having a treatment. So yes, there are well-established formulas for calculating how much disability sight loss creates. And so they have a formula really to say this, it has to improve quality of life by this much to be cost effective. And so that does help drive the price down. It's very transparent what has to be achieved.
I suspect this question is possibly for Colin. You there, Colin?
I am here, yeah.
Somebody would love to hear about assistive technology that can be helpful. That's probably more than we can cover in a short period of time, but would you like to say something about that?
Yeah, cool. Well, it starts very simply at just making things bigger, and which is assistive technology, whichever way you look at it. High contrast, so reducing glare on a screen by turning it round the other way, so it's colours on a black background rather than colours on a white background or a lighter background, reduces glare, which means everything stands out a bit more. And then you start making things bigger, so magnifiers, digital magnifiers, handheld magnifiers, right up to when that starts to be more difficult or more complicated, we start moving on to text-to-speech. So things start to speak out when you interact with them. So from having magnification with some supported speech right up to what I use, which is a full screen reader, where everything gets spoken out. But lots of this stuff now is just built in into iPhones and Android phones and tablets and bits and pieces. So those costs are actually coming down, which is quite good. But again, it's just about learning how to use them, and they're a bit frustrating at the beginning. But there's stuff out there that's really useful, and I'm always willing to have a conversation with someone on the phone. And you can drop me an email, and I'll point you in the right direction. So, I've been using a screen reader now for 20 years, or what, 25 years? Oh gosh, actually, it's nearly 30. Good grief. So, I know my stuff. So, if you want to have a proper conversation, just contact me directly, and I'm quite happy to have a conversation about what potentially could support you. Professor Lowtreath, really thank you ever so much for joining us this evening. I personally found it a really interesting chat. I will be quite honest, I don't take a lot of interest in my vision and Stargardt disease myself, so other than for work purposes. So I've actually learned quite a lot about my own eyesight tonight, which is always quite interesting. So thanks ever so much for coming along, and we shall we shall do another one of these at some point next year. That's really great. As for everybody, really thank you for coming along. It's been a really good talk. There's been some really good questions in the chat. Jerry, thank you as always for coming along. And that's it. So thanks ever so much for joining us, and we'll speak to you all soon.